From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. November ends after a long weekend for some, but also ends with the U.S. logging an additional 4 million confirmed cases of COVID-19. 4 million in just 1 month. And after that aforementioned weekend, there's fear of a surge superimposed on the surge, as Anthony Fauci put it. His colleague on the White House Coronavirus Task Force, Coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx, delivered this warning to Thanksgiving travelers yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation.
You need to be tested about 5 to 10 days later, but you need to assume that you're infected.
So with that in mind, we're going to check in on three locations around the country. And let's start in Florida, which is fast approaching 1 million cases. WMFE reporter Danielle Pryor is in Orlando. And Danielle, how are your hospitals doing? How much capacity do they have right now?
We're doing all right, but we are seeing hospitalizations increase and rise steadily throughout the state, kind of similar to what we saw at our peak, our last peak here in mid-July. We are getting very close to 1 million cases since mid-March.
Yeah, and almost half of all the new cases are in South Florida. Why is that such a hot spot?
That's right. I think, you know, if anything, this pandemic has highlighted the inequalities in our healthcare system in this country. And in a lot of Spanish-speaking Latino communities in South Florida is where we're seeing these new cases, simply because they don't have equal access to COVID-19 testing, they don't have free PPE, and they don't necessarily always have information that's accessible in Spanish and other indigenous languages. And we're seeing surge teams going into these communities now, trying to hand out face masks and information in Spanish, but it might be, you know, too little, too late.
Yeah. Well, as you know, Florida does not have a statewide mask order in place.
Right.
And in September, your governor, Ron DeSantis, lifted most pandemic restrictions. So what's happening at the state or even at the local level right now to try to stop the spread?
Statewide, we're seeing very little. You might know that our governor has been MIA since November 4th. There's been no press conference until actually right now. Right now, he's holding one in Kissimmee, which is here in Central Florida. But other than that, there's really been no word from him or his administration about the surge that we're seeing. Locally, I think we've seen a lot of mass mandates in place, but there's no way to enforce them. Our governor has just extended an executive order that bans all local governments from imposing fines or fees that would make it possible to actually enforce mask mandates. So we're seeing them being put in place. But, you know, when you can't find somebody, it's very hard to tell somebody to wear a mask who doesn't want to.
WMFE's Danielle Pryor joining us from Orlando. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Let's go now to South Dakota, where as of last Friday, the coronavirus has killed one out of every 1,000 residents, and where more than 40% of COVID tests are coming back positive, according to Johns Hopkins University. South Dakota Public Broadcasting reporter Seth Tupper is in Rapid City. And Seth, another statistic we should note, this Saturday, South Dakota reported its largest death toll since the pandemic started. How are things going there?
Well, it has been pretty dire here, especially since September. Just this past Saturday, we set our single-day record with a reported 54 deaths reported in one day from COVID-19. And that surge has continued for the past few months. Recently, we have seen, within the past couple of weeks, for the first time in months, our curve of new infections did dip slightly. So hopefully that's not a blip, and hopefully it's a sustained trend. But the deaths and illnesses and hospitalizations have been rising at an alarming rate here throughout the fall.
Well, you say an alarming rate, and you're right. But is it alarming people? Because as we know, South Dakota is one of the states without very tough restrictions. In fact, your governor has gone so far as to tell people this weekend to go shopping. So, I mean, how are people approaching this problem?
Well, they're very divided. As you noted, our Republican governor, Kristi Noem, she's been very anti-mask mandate. She's been very anti-lockdown. She's opposed to any sort of a statewide mandate. And so what that has caused is sort of a conflicting message to be out there. Our state public health officials are telling people to wear masks and stay home if possible. And last week, 600 South Dakota physicians attached their names to a full-page newspaper ad that ran in every daily paper in the state asking people to take more precautions, including wearing masks. But then you have the governor also encouraging people to get together for Thanksgiving and saying South Dakota won't stop you from doing that like some other states.
Yeah, well, one of the challenges that you have there in South Dakota, it's also a rural state. rural hospitals are not always equipped the same way as they are in big cities. How are your hospitals holding up?
Generally, so far, so good. Our state health officials say our hospitals, of course, have been stretched and stressed, but they haven't gone over capacity yet. For example, right now, we still have about 20% of the ICU beds in the state that remain available. That number has dwindled, and of course, if things get worse, that would be concerning. But with the number of infections recently leveling off and dipping a little bit, there's hope that perhaps we won't get to the point where we're over capacity in those hospitals.
All right, Seth Tupper, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's go now to New York City, where Mayor Bill de Blasio announced yesterday that public elementary schools will reopen for in-person learning next week, and some students with disabilities can also return.
We know, first of all, studies consistently show that younger kids are having less of a negative experience and there's less concern about the spread when it comes to younger kids.
Len de Blasio also mentioned that younger kids at home can be much tougher on parents, but this reopening comes after schools were closed down less than 2 weeks ago to national reaction. It was a firestorm. Let's bring in Jessica Gould, who covers education for WNYC in New York City. So, Jessica, what happened here? Was it that reaction?
I think the reaction was definitely part of it. But, you know, the mayor here, Mayor de Blasio, has pushed so hard to reopen schools. And when he did, it was seen as a major triumph for the city's recovery. But he also promised teachers and families that when the average positivity rate here hit 3%, that he'd shut down the schools to show how careful he was going to be about reopening. And then when we did hit that threshold about a week and a half ago, he went ahead and closed the schools. But at the time, he said he was working immediately on reopening them, and this plan is what we got yesterday.
Yeah. Well, it started a national conversation about whether or not young kids are as negatively impacted by COVID-19, and a lot of, you know, people were saying, well, actually, kids are wearing masks, they're socially distancing, they're not as negatively impacted with outbreaks and such. It's teachers and staff that, you know, people are concerned about, and still kids going back and forth. But now, under half of the school's kids have actually opted for in-person learning. So a lot of kids won't actually be going physically back. Just describe what's going to happen.
Sure. So the school system here is about 1 million students. And two-thirds of those families have actually opted to keep their kids at home. So this applies to the third of families who have elected to go in person. And of that, about 190,000 are, you know, in elementary school or have the severe disabilities that will reopen schools next week.
And de Blasio also said, we should say, middle and high schools are going to stay closed. So some parents might be thinking, if I've got some kids home, I might as well have all my kids learning at home. So how's it going to work? Is there going to increase testing? What are they going to do?
Yeah, they are increasing testing. So previously it was monthly tests of a sample of about 20% of students per school. Now that's going to happen weekly. And a significant change is that students won't be able to come to school unless they have signed consent forms saying that they can be tested. And, you know, fewer than half of families had actually signed those consent forms before. So mandating that is a big change.
Yeah. Well, overall, what's been the reaction from teachers' unions, from parents?
So the teachers' union says that it supports this plan. And it's important to note that there are still possibilities for closures. There are closures based on multiple cases that demonstrate a spread in schools, individual schools, and then in zones of the city that have really high rates. That's under the state's requirements for business and school closures for a period of time in those areas. So the union says it supports that plan. And parents who send their kids to in-person learning say they're really in favor of sending their kids back. It's been a positive experience. But a lot of the families whose kids have chosen remote and have been learning remotely have said that that experience is really subpar. And with the potential for more kids going back in person more days a week under this plan, it's possible that the disparities could get even wider.
Yeah. We know that people watch New York City because it has such a big of everything, including school systems, because it's had such a big COVID-19 outbreak, because cases, you know, well, we just saw one go to the Supreme Court deciding whether the state's governor there could close, you know, or ask religious institutions in those certain hot zones, as you call them, for COVID-19 to reduce their attendance there. But just overall, what is your sense of when this ship turns around? I mean, it's a huge ship. What is your sense there, or people's sense there, of when things are back to normal and kids are going to school in New York City?
The mayor says that when the vaccine is widely available, that's when we'll be able to return to school as we know it. And until then, we're just going to have to do the best we can.
Yeah. Well, as a fellow New Yorker, I'm sure it will be the very best that everybody can. Jessica Gould, who covers education for WNYC, on the mayor's announcement in the city that some kids, school kids, elementary school kids, will be going back to school if they want to. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anti-vaxxers have been spreading false fears about vaccination since the pandemic began. But health officials are worried about doubters with a well-founded distrust of the medical community, which experimented first on slaves and into the last century on Black Americans. A survey by the COVID-19 Collaborative found only 14% of Black Americans said they thought a coronavirus vaccine would be safe. Studies show Black and Latino communities face disproportionate exposure to the virus, living largely in urban areas, and the CDC says they're more likely to get infected, get sick, or die.
We affirm that Black lives matter. And as Black health professionals, we have a higher calling to stand for racial justice and to fight for health equity.
Well, health professionals in the Black Coalition Against COVID-19 are reaching out. In this PSA, they say vaccine makers have to earn the trust of Black Americans, but
we also ask you to join us in participating in clinical trials and taking a vaccine once it's proven safe and effective. We know that our collective role in helping to create a vaccine that works for Black people and that we trust has an impact on our very survival.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Reverend Liz Walker, pastor of Roxbury Presbyterian Church.
The Reverend Liz Walker in Boston went a step further. She organized a Zoom meeting and invited Dr. Anthony Fauci, who came and took her questions.
In my community, which is a poorer community, a marginalized community, and a community that is disproportionately represented by COVID victims, I know those numbers are higher in my community. So what do you say to these people? How are you persuading people to take these vaccines?
I think what one needs to do is to try and find out, is it a broad generic reason, a distrust of the medical establishment because of the history of the abuse, particularly of the African-American community, with things that date back as far as Tuskegee and Henrietta Lacks issues? Or is it something about the process of the speed with which this vaccine was developed and somewhat of the mixed signals that one has been getting in this divisive society from Washington?
So what is the problem? The Reverend Walker joins us now. And Reverend Liz, why did you even do this Zoom call?
I was really surprised at how many parishioners, how many people, not just in the church, but in the community, said they weren't going to take the vaccine, the distrust. So I wanted to do something about that because I, you know, sincerely believe we need to take it.
By the way, did people cite the Tuskegee Project of the 1930s? Black men were experimented on and not given treatment for syphilis. Some may have had grandparents who lived through that. Or Henrietta Lacks, doctors harvested her cancer cells, companies made millions, never told her family. We've also seen the sterilization of Black women in gynecological research.
Everybody cited Tuskegee. That's a story that has been in my community for generations, so that's not a new story to us. But people were also talking about their personal experiences with healthcare. We have a program for people who have suffered trauma through violence or, you know, abuse and neglect. And those people said they would never, ever take a vaccine because they had been abused, they had been neglected, they had been ignored, they had been disrespected. So many personal experiences of going to a hospital or going to a doctor and feeling that you're not being taken seriously. So people are saying, no, we're not going to do it. I think it also speaks to the larger issue of this summer, this horrible summer with the shootings of Black men, the injustice there, the idea that Black people are disproportionately affected by COVID. It's, you know, it's ironic, but the very reason that we, you know, we feel we're getting sicker is because we feel we haven't been properly dealt with in the healthcare arena. So all of these add up to distrust, and people just don't want to do it. Now you add to that the political situation. So you have a perfect storm of problems in my community of wanting to take this vaccine. They are very real. They are embedded, and they won't easily be pulled out.
Well, but you have made this attempt. You had this forum with Dr. Fauci. By the way, did you just call him?
I called his office. I can't even explain it even now what happened. In my tradition, I say this is a God thing. That's the only way I can describe it, because I emailed his assistant. His assistant got right back to me the next day. I was shocked. It was just, let's try it. But who knew it was going to, you know, work out that way?
Well, I'll comment on that in a moment. But you started this evening at the point where Dr. Fauci is there. You turn and asked him the question of the night. What would he say to Black people? Dr. Fauci went on to talk about the safety of the vaccine, how the studies are reviewed, said that he and his family would be willing to get these vaccines. But pick up on what he said. The people you're speaking of in your community, these aren't anti-vaxxers by and large. And there are many white people who are also wondering about the safety of these vaccines. Given that there is a distrust because this vaccine has been fast-tracked by this administration, you alluded to this, the politics of this, we can dispassionately say President Trump often lies.
I think that really feeds into it. I think that just adds to the distrust about the vaccine. There is a growing distrust about everything in this country. I don't think it's limited to African Americans or people of color. I think it's across culture, across race. And that has to be fixed. We have to approach that. I thought Dr. Fauci was wonderful when he talked about transparency. He explained that there's a depth of testing and a depth of kind of a checks and balances among the scientists that goes beyond politics. And that was the thing he said that touched me, that there are people who are doing this. It has nothing to do with politics. They're not even close to the political level of this. That gave me a little bit more confidence. So I think he addressed it directly. But it's a deep problem. It is a deep problem.
You've spoken to people since the forum. Were they swayed?
I've spoken to a few people who are, yes, a little swayed. And some people thought they had more to think about. I also think that as this goes on and the vaccine is given out and people begin to see what's happening and get responses from other people who have taken it, I think that's going to change minds too. But I think it takes a little of all of that to really, you know, change people's minds. And it's going to take some time for some people who said they will never take it.
Yeah. Well, look, the FDA reportedly sat with comments that a research group had from Black Americans talking about how they felt about the vaccine. They looked at these comments. We're not going to be guinea pigs again. Remember Tuskegee. So the government is aware of it. And as we said, Black leaders are aware of it. The Black Coalition Against COVID-19 was co-founded by leaders, including Howard University's president, a doctor. Two presidents of historically Black schools have announced they are test subjects in vaccination trials. Is this part of it too? Will you, you know, Reverend Liz, roll up your sleeve and maybe take a shot publicly?
Absolutely. I've been thinking about that a lot because that is really where the rubber meets the road. But I think it's going to take that kind of leadership. And after all, that's what I'm supposed to be as a preacher. Yeah. So I think I will do it. A lot of other people are stepping up to this plate, and that gives me inspiration. So I think the more of us that do it, the more it'll continue and then change may come. I say that with hope, great hope.
I have to make an observation and a disclosure. We've known each other for a while. Before you were a wildly popular pastor, you were a wildly popular news anchor. You walked away to go to divinity school. And Liz, it's striking me that you are perfectly positioned to get out not just the good news, but this life-saving medical news.
I absolutely feel that call. And that was affirmed for me by something that Dr. Fauci said. We asked him, you know, how he handles all of the abuse and persecution he's personally taken. And he said, he didn't use the language of call, which is the language of my tradition, but he did say this was his purpose. This was his meaning. This was what, this is what he got up out of bed for, to pass, you know, to get the word out and to do his job. And I feel very much connected to that. This was not something I had set, you know, I sat down, Robin, and said, I'm going to do this. It kind of just developed, and I'm humbled to be a part of it.
Well, and none of us are surprised that your call to Dr. Fauci ended up in his agreeing to be part of your event. And you asked him at the end of the evening, his part, to speak to, as you put it, your community. We want to listen to some of that. Let's listen.
I, over the last almost a year, have witnessed the disproportionate suffering that your community has gone through. It is something that is really extraordinarily unfortunate. And the reasons for that, I do hope when this is all over, we address, namely the social determinants of health and the inequities that you've been faced with essentially forever. I totally understand what you've been through. And I plead with you that we as a community, your community, the community that we all live in, can do something about this. If we abide by the public health measures and get vaccinated, don't deprive yourself of the advantage of an extraordinarily important advance in science by not getting vaccinated. Protect yourselves, your family, and your community.
Dr. Anthony Fauci speaking at a forum organized by the Reverend Liz Walker and her colleague, Reverend Gloria White Hammond, from the Roxbury Presbyterian Church in Boston. We'll link you to the event at hereandnow.org. Liz, Reverend Walker, thank you.
Robin, thank you.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
Well, the calendar says it's November 30th, and that means it's the end of what's been a very busy hurricane season. Jeff Huffman is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, welcome back. I'm looking at the National Hurricane Center map, and there's only one potentially threatening weather system in the Atlantic, but it's thousands of miles off the U.S. coast. Is it safe to say hurricane season is really over?
Yeah, well, remember, it's us humans who have declared the official start and stop date of the season. So theoretically, another storm could form. There have been 17 of them in December over the past 170 years. But if a storm forms, Peter, it's extremely rare for it to hit the U.S. After November 30th, and it would likely be weak anyway due to cooler waters and frequent cold fronts. So fingers crossed, but I think we are certainly done with serious hurricane threats this year.
Well, that's good. And looking back, put what happened this year into more context for us. 12 storms made landfall in the continental United States. If you were writing the history of this hurricane season, what would you say?
Well, that's it. I mean, there were 30 named storms, which is now a record, but the number of landfalls really stands out. And in particular, what happened in Louisiana. You know, every mile of U.S. coastline along the Atlantic and the Gulf this year was at some point threatened. For example, we had a tropical storm watch or a storm surge watch or warning for every single mile of coastline at some point.
Wow.
But in Louisiana, a state that only has an annual probability of landfall of 30%, which is rather high compared to some other states, but, you know, take a 30% probability of landfall any given year, that's from a hurricane. They had three hurricane landfalls this year. So I think that's what's going to stand out most about 2020.
Yeah, and 2020 was the fifth consecutive year with an above normal Atlantic hurricane season. The trend, if you go back, it's much further than that. According to NOAA, there have been 18 above normal seasons out of the past 26. We know ocean water temperatures are warmer, but I mean, what is happening exactly?
Well, there are so many signals that contribute to tropical cyclone activity, some on the global scale, some more related to the hemisphere or the actual ocean. You know, the normals that we're comparing the numbers to do go back to 1980 or 1981. So we are in a more active period. But the climate change signals, even though they're not as high for tropical cyclones, my colleague Dr. Athena Masson here has also done some research related to this. And, you know, the number of cyclones are going up, so the number of landfalls would go up. And even more apparent is the number of rapid intensifications we had. 10 cyclones this year rapidly intensified, which also ties a record from 1995. So there are certainly some signals that climate change is playing a role, but it may be a couple of decades from now before we can determine whether or not this more recent active period is playing a bigger role in what we're seeing this year.
And is it too early to know what next year might be like?
It is just a little bit in terms of specifics, but we can tell that we're entering into a La Nina pattern, which is the biggest signal for tropical cyclone activity in the Atlantic. The La Nina is the cooling of the Pacific waters on the other side of the North American continent. There's a chance that that may continue through next fall. If it does, it tends to correlate to higher than normal activity in the Atlantic. At least that's the direction we're trending right now. Hopefully nothing like we saw this year. But of course, every year we prepare the same and encourage our listeners up and down the Atlantic and Gulf Coast to do that as well.
And we'll have you back on next year, Jeff. Jeff Huffman, Director and Chief Meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Thanks for all that you've done for us over the past few months. We appreciate it.
It's always our pleasure. Thank you, Peter.
There is a series of big questions people really want answered. When will the first coronavirus vaccines be coming out? How good will they be? And who will get them first? Well, there's news today on all those fronts. The biotech firm Moderna announced this morning that it's applying for emergency use authorization of its coronavirus vaccine. Researchers say it's 94% effective, and it's especially good at preventing severe cases of the disease. In the next few weeks, an FDA advisory committee will consider approving it and another vaccine developed by Pfizer. And tomorrow, top officials at the CDC are expected to vote on prioritizing who gets those vaccines first and when. Julie Robner has been watching these developments, as well as health policy questions in the lame duck Congress. She's chief Washington correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And on NBC News last week, Biden said he may or may not keep President Trump's still unseen plan to roll out a coronavirus vaccine. And he also outlined who he thinks should get the shots first. Let's listen.
The docs, the nurses, those people who are the first responders. I think we should also be focusing on being able to open schools as rapidly as we can. I think it can be done safely.
So, Julie, we are getting tantalizingly close here to having these shots distributed. How soon can we expect it and who's going to get them?
Well, there is talk that we could actually have the first round of vaccines by the end of December, which really would be an amazing thing, given, you know, how fast this has all gone. We don't know exactly who's going to get them. Certainly, we assume that healthcare workers are going to be right at the front of the line, as they should be. They're the most exposed to the virus. After that, it's an interesting question. Earlier recommendations had said that people in congregate living facilities, which are mostly seniors in nursing homes, would be next on the list. But now there's starting to be some concerns that do you really want to give this vaccine to seniors first before it's been given to, you know, younger people if there is a longer term, you know, side effect issue? Maybe you don't want seniors to be right at the front of the line. That's something that the CDC advisory committee is going to have to chew over. I think what President-elect Biden was saying about, you know, perhaps adults in educational settings so that we could open schools, you know, might well rise higher on the list. There's already, we're seeing a move to open certainly elementary schools and you know, get the younger kids who are just not doing that well, going to school on the computer, back into a, you know, a physical building.
In order to do any of that, states and the incoming Biden administration are going to need money to roll out this vaccine. How important is a coronavirus relief bill getting passed through Congress going to be to make sure that the rollout of the vaccines can go smoothly?
Well, it's really, really important. I mean, this is an enormous logistical undertaking. You know, you can't plan it in too much detail right now because we don't know which of these vaccines is going to be available first and in what supply. And obviously the Pfizer vaccine has to be kept at this extremely cold temperature, which will make distribution more difficult. The Moderna vaccine, not as much. So that will impact how it's distributed. But, you know, states and localities are really in dire straits. This has been the fight in Congress. The Republicans in the Senate do not want to give money to state and local governments. And yet state and local governments are the ones who pay these frontline workers who are going to be really important to distributing this vaccine. And that's been the standoff in Congress so far. It's not so much been relief for individuals and small businesses, which there's general bipartisan agreement on. Just Democrats want to give more relief and Republicans want to give less. But it's been this issue about state and local governments.
And then the question is, who will be in charge? We're starting to get names, potential names, for a Biden administration cabinet. What are we hearing on Health Secretary and how they might shape this whole process?
Well, before we get to that, we should point out that the distribution of this vaccine is not just going to be the Department of Health and Human Services. It's really a whole of government undertaking. It's going to involve possibly the Defense Department, certainly the Department of Homeland Security. Yes, it will be, you know, the Secretary of Health and Human Services will be among the most important people in this effort. And there's really sort of, you know, you never know who it's going to be, but there's two names that have been kicked around the most. One of them is Vivek Murthy, who was the Surgeon General under President Obama and has been working on the Biden transition and was an advising candidate Biden. The other is New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, who herself was health secretary for a while before she was governor and who's also served in Congress and who probably has a little more experience managing, you know, large organizations, which the Department of Health and Human Services definitely is. So we'll have to see who eventually gets picked.
Yeah. Further down the road, Julie, I'm wondering what might happen with the Affordable Care Act. The Supreme Court just recently heard a case in which the future of the Obama-era law is at stake. And then we also have the issue of whether or not the Senate stays in Republican hands or flips to Democratic control. What is the future of the Affordable Care Act under a Biden administration?
It depends. I mean, as you said, it depends most importantly on whether the Democrats or Republicans control the Senate. If the Republicans maintain control by winning one or both of the Georgia runoffs in January, then it will be very difficult to get any of the things that that President-elect Biden has ran on regarding the Affordable Care Act, expanding subsidies, creating a public option, basically making technical fixes that Congress has not been able to make since the law passed in 2010 because Republicans took over the House that year and Democrats have not controlled Congress since then. If Republicans maintain control, it's going to be really hard for him to do much expanding. Of course, there is this wild card of what the Supreme Court might do. After the oral arguments earlier in November, there was sort of the assumption that this case that is challenging the entire validity of the law wasn't really going to go anywhere. But I think, you know, last week's case regarding closures of religious meetings and gatherings for public health reasons, the Chief Justice was outvoted by the five other conservatives. And it's conceivable that that could happen on the Affordable Care Act also. So there are still a lot of question marks.
Let's just play that out. Let's say the Supreme Court does strike it down and Congress is divided like it has been for years. What happens then?
That's a really interesting question. That would basically call Republicans bluff. Republicans have been saying since this law passed that they want to repeal it and then later to repeal it and replace it. They've never been able to come up with a replacement. Obviously, the House is going to still be under Democratic control, so it's not like the Republicans could put in their own replacement anyway. I think at that point, they would probably have to sue for peace if the entire law was struck down. And it would be interesting to see, you know, they would probably not want to put the law in its entirety back, but I would expect they would put large portions of it back. And that's if only because moderate moderate Republicans in the Senate would probably go with the Democrats, that this would be an enormous blow. And I don't think it would be tenable for the Republicans just to say, okay, it's gone.
Hmm. Finally, Julie, I want to ask you, where do you think progressives stand right now on the issue of health care? They'll have a moderate president in the White House who says he doesn't support Medicare for all. And again, a Congress that appears to be very closely divided. Have progressives just given up on this idea of Medicare for all for now?
I don't think they've given up on it, but I'm actually kind of surprised that they are recognizing reality in a way that didn't happen either back in 1993 when there was a big Medicare for all push, and obviously in 2010 when there was a big Medicare for all push. I think they recognize the reality of the situation, which is that, you know, even if the Senate is in Democratic hands, it's going to be a gigantic push just to get a public option, which is not anywhere near Medicare for all. So I think they realize that they need to just sort of bide their time and continue to build support. But, you know, usually Democrats get into this sort of intra-party hand-to-hand combat. And at least so far, it's really early. We haven't seen that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We just don't know what's going to happen because of the Supreme Court ruling and also because of this Senate runoff, two races in Georgia. So we're going to know soon. But until then, we'll just have to keep talking about it. Julie Robner, Chief Washington Correspondent at Kaiser Health News. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We know the surge in COVID-19 cases is straining first responders, but also last responders. If hospitals are at capacity, funeral homes and morgues will soon follow. That's the warning from Dr. Lauren Knight. She's chief medical examiner and coroner for Washoe County, Nevada, the state's second most populous county, home to Reno. And so, Dr. Knight, what is the COVID-19 situation there?
Well, unfortunately, we're seeing an unprecedented surge here in Washoe County, and we're very concerned about that number increasing because it is taxing our funeral homes to store the bodies in refrigeration, as is required by law and decency. And we're concerned that as these numbers continue to double, that we may actually exceed that capacity. We have more capacity here at the medical examiner's office, but typically that is used more for unnatural deaths, so deaths that are due to violence or trauma, and those are the deaths that fall under our jurisdiction typically. We only investigate COVID-19 deaths when they are sudden, unexpected, or just an unknown diagnosis. And so our storage capacity is really more for those cases, and funeral homes are beginning to be overwhelmed. Some of our larger funeral homes are at over 90% capacity for their storage.
Yeah. Well, I just want to ask you about something you just said, because we don't want to add to the disinformation about this incredible number of COVID-19 deaths that you and medical examiners across the country are concerned about. Because as you all know, there's, you know, confusion, to put it kindly, and disinformation, to put it bluntly, from people like now Senator-elect Roger Marshall of Kansas, who claimed that only 6% of the number of, you know, 200,000 plus deaths across the U.S., only 6% of those are really COVID-19, that the other deaths are things like, you know, heart-related or disease-related outside of COVID-19. Could you settle this? How do medical examiners determine a COVID-19 death?
Well, I can tell you that it's absolutely not true that only a small minority of the deaths attributed to COVID-19 are truly related to that disease. That's just simply not true.
Well, someone put it so simply, did they die sooner than they would have if they didn't have the virus? If the answer is yes, then it's because of COVID-19. So thanks for clearing that up. But, you know, as you and others are saying, they're dying in such numbers from COVID-19 that you may not have room for them. Are you considering what you were considering at the other surge in the spring, bringing in, you know, refrigerator trucks?
Yes. So in the spring, we did bring in refrigerated containers, and we did place those outside of our facility. And fortunately, we didn't need to use them. Since then, in May, we were fortunate to be able to put in a permanent auxiliary body cooler behind our facility that holds about 140 bodies so that we would be ready as this pandemic goes on, because we felt that it was going to be for the long haul and there were potentially going to be multiple surges. Now, other things that we might do are to increase cremations at our funeral homes, to run cremations 24 hours a day, and also to bring in refrigerated containers again if we exceed the capacity we already have. If we exceed the availability of refrigerated trucks or refrigerated containers and then go beyond that, then we would have to consider temporary burial of deceased at a location that we haven't determined yet. So I really hope that we won't get there. I hope that we will be able to contain this pandemic with the right actions. But I am afraid that if people are not listening to the recommendations to stay home during the holidays, that we may have more surges.
Why do you think that you've had this surge even before the holidays?
I think that people are really pandemic fatigued. And we're seeing not only COVID fatalities, but we're also seeing increases in other types of fatalities because of the stress on people. We're seeing increased drug-related deaths. We're seeing more homicides this year than we did the year prior. And I think all of these are attributable to pandemic-related stress. So I certainly recognize that it's hard for people to live under these constraints, but it's what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to wear our masks. We're going to have to stay away from other people, even during the holidays, or we're going to have a tremendous surge that's going to overwhelm hospitals and create an untenable situation with the number of fatalities and the number of people ill in our region.
Let's just ask you, we know about doctors who are and nurses, healthcare workers who are having such burnout right now, and they're seeing so much death. Your work is death. Has this taken a toll even on you and the people you work with?
I think so. I think for last responders, there's an increased stress level now. We are just seeing a large number of fatalities, more than previous years. So It has been a stressful and busy time for me and my staff. And we're just going to keep plugging away to serve the public. But it's hard not to get burnt out.
That's Dr. Laura Knight, Chief Medical Examiner and Coroner for Washoe County, Nevada. Dr. Knight, thank you so much, and good luck with your work.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
We cannot forget the last responders. We thank them for their work. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.